Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, sanitation and antibiotics have saved the lives of many, but are they also culprits behind some of our modern diseases? But first, what is the role of the United States in promoting peace between Israel and Palestine? What's the likelihood of its success? Our contributing host, Doug Becker, explores this and more.
The United States' peace plan for Israel and Palestine departs significantly from past plans. From altered borders that decrease the size of land for Palestine to a lack of commitment to Palestinian sovereignty, the proposal was immediately endorsed by Israel and rejected by the Palestinians. On today's show, we examine the plan, how it departs from previous proposals, and whether it will serve as a foundation for future negotiations. On our panel today, we have Brent Sasley, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Texas Arlington. He is author of Politics of Israel, Governing a Complex Society, and a recent piece for the Washington Post on the peace proposal. And Fayez Hamad, who is a lecturer of International Relations and Middle East Studies at the University of Southern California and a frequent commentator on Middle East politics. Brent Sasley, we'll turn first to you. What is it about this proposal that makes it different than previous peace proposals the U.S. has advanced for peace between the Israelis and Palestinians?
I would say that there are two main differences. First, the paper itself or the proposal, the document is over 100 pages. So on the one hand, it's very vague because it actually leaves the door open to a number of possibilities, but it's trying to be very specific in terms of, you know, the very specific pieces of land that might be at issue or might be negotiated over, the specific economic policies that both Palestinians and Israelis and the international community can engage in. And so it's does something that other American peace plans had never done, which is to try to provide a number of specific elements or points for the two parties to negotiate over. And that's new. And I'm not sure that's a good thing. But the second thing is that it's pretty much an American rewrite of the Israeli rights positions regarding negotiations and the peace process. It takes the Israeli rights, perhaps the center rights, and certainly Benjamin Netanyahu, the prime minister, certainly takes his position on everything from what Israel can annex from the West Bank to where a Palestinian capital should be, i.e. not in Jerusalem, to how many Arab citizens of Israel might be transferred to a Palestinian state, and so on. And so that is, you know, the United States has been criticized for taking Israel's side more often than the Palestinians in past negotiations and peace processes, but this goes several steps beyond even that.
And Fayez Hamad, in what ways do you see this as different or similar to previous proposals?
Well, Brent is correct in that the United States have gave more preference to the Israeli positions over previous years and proposals. But this is first and foremost an Israeli proposal. It's an Israeli plan. And the whole idea behind this exercise is to get the United States endorsement of it. And if you read the 180 pages, actually, 100 of which are delegated to the economic discussion, none of the statements, positions, opinions are new. These are kind of frequent positions and statements propagated not only actually by the Likud government, but even by successive labor governments in the state of Israel. So the question, I guess, more simply, why now? Why are we going through this? And it seems the timing of it, you know, the most apparent one, I think it was when it was issued on a Tuesday, the week from last Tuesday, was the times of impeachment in the United States and a criminal indictment against Prime Minister Netanyahu in Israel, where his immunity request actually withdrew that from the parliament consideration. Then you have the presence of Trump himself in the White House, and one does not need to engage what Trump has been up to, not over this issue, but over other international issues and domestically, so that speaks for itself. And then you have the main authors of the proposal, which is, you know, Trump's Middle East team. You have Jared Kushner, David Friedman, the U.S. ambassador to Israel, and Jason Greenblatt, who was advisor on that. It just all came together, and it seems now time is of a sense. The thinking is that Trump leaves the White House, then this needs to be put in place, even if the Palestinians are not going to accept it. And every Israeli knew that they will not accept that. But at least the hope is that it will be the building block for next round of negotiation if and whenever they occur.
Could I just add to that also?
Yes, absolutely.
Or at least build on what Fayaz said. So he mentioned that this is the economic or the emphasis on economic factors reflects an Israeli position. Netanyahu himself, when he returned to power after his first premiership in 1996, he came back in 2009, one of the things that he started to emphasize was what he called an economic peace. And this was essentially, in practice, it was an effort to develop the Palestinian economy and rebuild institutions so that Palestinians could be wealthier, safer, more secure, and so on. But really what it was designed to do was to sort of put aside political negotiations towards statehood and self-determination and independence and make the argument that, you know what, things on the ground are not good, so let's focus on building up that, and then maybe later on we can talk about, we can engage in a negotiation process and talk about a Palestinian state and that kind of thing. This plan, and not surprisingly, as Fayaz mentioned, put together by people who are either close to Netanyahu or who think that Netanyahu is the one that they should listen to, really reflects this emphasis on an economic peace, that the Palestinians don't deserve political statehood or anything like that, at least not yet. The key is to focus on the economic factors. It's sort of a bribe, and it's meant to say, look, we can provide you with more prosperity, maybe you'll be happier and you won't push for something more.
To dig into some of the specifics, because we've talked about how broadly how this has varied from previous proposals, but previous proposals have focused on a two-state solution, a border that reflects some similarity to the initial partition resolution that the UN had proposed in the 1940s or the 1967 borders, and then the city of Jerusalem and a question about what to do with the city of Jerusalem. So first of all, is this a departure from the two-state model that has typically been proposed? And also, how does it reflect the questions of borders? Fayaz Hamad, we'll start with you.
Sure. The two-state solution is predicated on UN Security Council Resolution 242, mm-hmm. which you referred to as adopted by the UN in 1967. It's a kind of quid pro quo formula, land for peace, as it came to be known, where Israel was requested to withdraw from territories it occupied in that recent conflict in exchange for peace agreements and treaties with the Arab states. And the thinking has been since then, and including, you know, all relevant parties, superpowers, the United States included, was that Israel was to withdraw from the nearly all territories, and where that has been actually adopted in the case of Egypt, when Israel withdrew from the Sinai Peninsula, and a peace treaty followed, and also with Jordan, although there were not significant territorial issues between the two, outside the West Bank, which by that time Jordan had abdicated its rights to the Palestinians. So the assumption has been since the beginning was to create a Palestinian, independent Palestinian state in the territories that is the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. And that was based on 242, in other words, international law and relevant UN resolutions. What's been happening for the last 20 years, and this began to take place under the Clinton administration and the U.S.-sponsored peace process during the 1990s, they was start walking away from that principle, and it was replaced by the kind of perspective of the party's needs. In other words, the question of rights was put aside, and in its place arose the idea that the parties have specific needs. And in this case, Israel's needs were to trump other needs. Hence, the demand for more security, for more territories in the occupied territories, for Israel's need to maintain settlements, Israel's needs not to allow refugees to come back, Israel needs to have unified Jerusalem, and so on and so forth. So that process began gradually in the 1990s. When the Obama administration came along, it attempted to walk away from that, restoring the need to reference relevant UN resolutions. But as we know, that went nowhere. Now, in this round under the Trump proposal, it's farther away, the farthest ever away from UN resolution. In fact, it says these have been a source of the source of the obstacle in reaching peace between the two parties. and hence squarely Israeli needs, and not just any Israeli needs, are the far-right extremist parties within Israel, which calls for the annexation of these territories and all the other issues, which have been referred to as the final status issues as that process evolved in the 1990s, the refugees, the question of Jerusalem, borders, security, water, and all of that.
Brent Sasley, then, in talking about some of the specific territories, I know some of the emphasis is that this proposal gives Israel a green light to be able to annex territories in the so-called West Bank, in the Jordan River Valley, and thereby kind of, I mean, at one level, moving the borders so that more of what was proposed, for instance, in the 1990s, some of the final status talks in the Oslo Accords, that was designated to be Palestinian, now could potentially become Israeli. How significant is this shift, the ability to annex territory in the Jordan River Valley?
Yes, if I'm remembering correctly, I believe that according to the plan, and if you look at the map and you kind of add up all the figures, I believe it gives Israel or opens the door, green lights for Israel to annex something like 30% of the West Bank, mm-hmm. but that the Palestinians would not get an equal amount of land swapped to them from Israeli territory. So the Palestinians would lose land under this plan that they had, or that we sort of think of based on past negotiations, including the Olmert-Abbas negotiations, discussions at Taba, even Camp David, although the numbers at Camp David were also not as strong as many people think, but even back then there was a little bit more. I think you're right that this plan is all about not just reducing the chances for a Palestinian state, but it's about conditioning the acceptance of Israeli annexation, Israeli swallowing up of West Bank land and making it part of Israel, part of sovereign Israel. You know, as the work that you do, you know, we know that the way we talk about things can shape our perceptions. Mm-hmm. And so it might be easy to dismiss this plan that, you know, it comes out of the Trump administration. They tend not to have, the administration has a kind of a bumbling, incompetent foreign policy, and you know, they go back and forth on different things. But when you put something down in text and you promote it as the policy of one of the, you know, the world's foremost power and the one that everybody looks to for mediating in Israeli-Palestinian talks, you're putting those ideas into the mainstream and you're making them part of the next series of negotiations. So this is now the basis, or at least that's the effort, or that's the worry, that this is now the basis. And I think that's why you see many groups resisting so firmly and fervently this effort to make this plan the negotiating position or the framework for Israeli-Palestinian peacemaking. Because once you put this into place and once you accept it, the Palestinians are starting at an even lower place than they were before, and you have a whole series of conditions or preconditions that favor Israel that now you kind of have to start from, and that completely disadvantages the Palestinians.
Fayez Hamad, I know one of the concerns, the Palestinians immediately rejected the proposal, but it was being reported that some more pro-U.S. Arab states, like the United Arab Emirates, though they didn't necessarily accept the plan, we're talking, you know, kind of very similarly to what Brent Sasley was suggesting, that, well, I mean, at least this can be the foundation for the next round of negotiations. How accurate was that reporting that the Trump administration is finding support within the Arab world, and that what had previously been a pretty unequivocal support for Palestinian positions in the Arab world might be cracking a bit?
Well, the attempts by the Trump administration to get some of its Arab allies supporting its plan is definitely in full display, particularly the attendance at the White House of the announcement of the proposal by the ambassadors of the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, and Oman, I believe. But the missing logic out of all of this is that, okay, well, United Arab Emirates wants to attend, but they really have no say on the matters on the ground, or credibility or connection to impose on Palestinians on behalf of the Israelis. So the view behind all of this is to further marginalize the Palestinian claims in arguing that, well, the view is that, you know, United States siding with the Israelis against the Palestinians will harm the American interests in the regions, and therefore, from that perspective, summing up or gathering some Arab states supportive of U.S. efforts will diminish this claim, so the argument goes, and as such will kind of further marginalize and weaken the Palestinian position and imposing on them an acceptance that they are not going to be able to live with. At the end of the day, in fact, the three ambassadors attended, but the Arab summit for at least the foreign ministers, all Arab states have rejected the Trump proposal. So these Arab states who seem to be supportive of the Trump plan try to kind of walk a tight rope where they don't want to openly antagonize the administration, and clearly they don't want to be ahead of well-entrenched and widely accepted and supported Palestinian claims at the mass level in the Arab world. So at the end of the day, it is the Palestinians who will have to decide on the matter, and the Israelis know that very well, and that's why the response of the Palestinians is the ultimate word in that, and the attempt is to weaken them further, to leave them with no options but to accept this so-called sovereignty, which has nothing to do with such a concept, and just pass it along.
So, Brent Sasley, to kind of turn back a bit to Israel here, some of the analysis is that this really has much to do with Israeli domestic politics. And Fayez actually suggested at some level the timing of this was connected to this indictment, this criminal indictment of the Israeli, you know, leader Benjamin Netanyahu. And we've referred to this as the position that's supported by the Israeli right. How well is this proposal being received within Israel, and what kind of, you know, what kind of reactions, what kind of political implications has it played for Israeli domestic politics, where it's pretty well established they're having difficulty finding a governing coalition?
So the conventional wisdom is that it was also partly meant to help Benjamin Netanyahu, who is now facing a third election in an extremely short period of time. It's this unprecedented moment in Israeli political history where no party has been able to get the support of 61 members of the Knesset, members of the parliament, in order to form a government. 61 is the majority out of 120. And so the argument is that this policy, showing that most of the Israeli positions are the ones being backed by the United States, will ultimately help Netanyahu. I don't think the evidence is clear yet. I mean, I think that was the assumption that many of these in the Trump administration thought, but the evidence is not clear. So some polling data has showed that Likud has not really gained that many seats. In fact, it's, according to some polls, the main challenger, Blue and White, has actually been ahead. Other polls have showed Likud a little bit ahead, but not really a major change in seats from the previous elections or from previous polling. At the same time, the term Palestinian state is mentioned in the report. And even though Netanyahu promised, and he continues to promise, that he will immediately annex not just the Jordan Valley, but all the settlements and more West Bank land and so on, many of the far right and settler organizations in Israel are unhappy. They're unhappy that it mentions a Palestinian state. They're unhappy that Netanyahu is not actually moving forward, though he said he would. And for them, keep in mind that even 30% of the West Bank is not enough. For them, any territory that goes to a Palestinian state is a reduction of the Jewish people's heritage, the capital L, land of Israel. And so even that is not something that is acceptable to them. So it's not clear that there has been a positive net effect for Netanyahu and the right just yet. What is interesting to watch is how Benny Gantz, who's one of the leaders of Blue and White, how he reacts. So he has kind of been waffling back and forth between adopting Netanyahu-esque positions by indicating he would support annexation, at least of the Jordan Valley, by kind of indicating that the Arab parties or the parties in Israel that represent that primarily entail representation of the Arab community, that he wouldn't work with them in a government. Yet at the same time, he has been very critical of Netanyahu, and he's kind of said that we can't do all of this without the international community. And so he's gone back and forth. And so it's really, I think he's in a difficult position and he's unable to gain traction either for or against the plan. Netanyahu is not really gaining because of the plan. So if that was the intention, and I think it was at least part of it, it's been a flop so far.
You're listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. We are discussing the U.S. proposal for peace and the possibility of peace between the Israelis and the Palestinians. Fayez Hamad.
Yes, definitely Netanyahu is trying to get any headlines that will ultimately support him at the polls, including his meeting, which was supposed to be kept in secret, with the Sudan's military leader, Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, that was held recently in Africa, to the dismay of the Sudanese military leader. Netanyahu announced the meeting. Furthermore, if one is reading correctly in the Israeli press, Netanyahu and his team, they're trying desperately to land a meeting with an Arab leader, the most prized of such a meeting. The possibility will be with that of MBS, Mohammed bin Salman, the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia. It is unlikely that it will happen, but the thinking that if Netanyahu would land such a meeting before the election on March the 2nd, that would help him at the poll. That goes into the saying, the kind of, you know, the desperation that Netanyahu is going through right now, because his continuation outside the court and the indictment proceedings lies in his continuation as a prime minister. So he's trying to win in any way possible, and putting all these shenanigans and stuff and putting all the stops there, which obviously remain to be seen, but that's definitely a factor that one cannot dismiss at this point.
I think that's important. Netanyahu's desperation is an important component of the equation here. We've already talked about the problems in the peace plan itself, but a further problem is that we have to remember that the administration released this plan at least in part to help Netanyahu's electoral chances. Yep. That's not a sound basis for American foreign policy. And it's a repudiation of decades of American policy as a mediator or facilitator in Israeli-Palestinian peace talks. And I think that that undermines and weakens the American position, not just in this arena, but it weakens American credibility in other negotiating arenas.
And with that, one of my great concerns is that the United States has positioned itself in this specific issue as being kind of the indispensable mediator, because they're the only ones who can deliver the Israelis. And even though the Arab world would probably, and Palestinians in particular, would probably prefer someone else, you know, serving as the role of mediator, there's nobody who could step up and again, be able to deliver the Israelis with at least some degree of credibility of a desire for peace. But this proposal moves in such a pro-Israel direction. The U.S. has now risked its position as this sort of essential mediator. So the obvious question then is, if not the U.S., then who? And I'll turn to Fayez Hamad. Are there any suggestions that, you know, if the U.S. is sort of, they've chosen their side and they're no longer seen as a credible mediator on the part of the Palestinians, is there another actor who can step in and play that role?
There is a way, but let me preface by saying the so-called peace process, since at least soon after 1967 war, and more certainly with the disengagement talks between the Israelis and Arab states under the mediation of the Nixon administration, and particularly the participation of Kissinger. The U.S. had insisted since then to have a peace process that is under its auspices and fully dominated by the United States. And no party had been able, actually there was not even an attempt to challenge such an approach. The European Union is completely impotent in that regard. And notwithstanding the statements supporting, you know, rights and all of that, no single or number of European powers were able to counterbalance or counter the weight of the United States. So the question is, what is left? Of course, one could think about perhaps rising other powers, whether Russia or China, but that's not going to be in any time in the foreseeable future, and one does not perhaps necessarily could hope for any better outcome on that. So to answer your question, one perhaps needs to, at this time, to step outside the box of this conventional approach, and it is up to the Israelis and the Palestinians, those who are concerned first and foremost about human rights, equality of citizenship, and protections. In other words, grassroots organizations, which is one, of course, would think perhaps unthinkable at this point, but you have Arab parties inside of Israel, you have Palestinian civil society organizations, you have definitely the Palestinian leadership is completely outside this this framework, because it's been more of a kind of a, on the side of the problem than its solution. Therefore, this is unfortunately a route that will not accomplish results soon or in the near future, but it's a struggle. Therefore, it will have to be accepted as perhaps an alternative. One point to emphasize the importance of that, part of this proposal included the possible provision where Arab towns near the border of the West Bank on the north west side of it were to be granted or given to the so-called Palestinian state, stripping nearly 300,000 to 400,000 Palestinians of Israeli citizens out of their citizenship. That faced objection not just by the Palestinians inside of Israel, but also objections by a wide range of Israelis across the board. In other words, this is the logical extension of such devices and plans, and perhaps such thinking will give hope for building along the lines of respect for international law, equality, and right-based approach, as opposed to this so-called sovereignty approach that we come to see as nothing but a gimmick.
So Brent Sasley, what's the way forward here? I guess first, have these previous proposals, a two-state solution based broadly on 1967 borders, I mean, has that ship sailed? And should the states themselves try to go back at some point, you know, to those proposals? Is this a sign that that peace process, that peace proposal has failed and we need some sort of a different approach? Or is peace even possible?
Unfortunately, I don't have a firm answer I can give you. You know, the two-state solution as a solution is kind of one of those things that until the conflict is actually ended in some way, technically, that idea is kind of always alive. I mean, there's always the hope for it. I think what you are seeing, though, is that as conditions on the ground, and by that I mean the Israeli occupation, now these changes with this American support for the Israeli position or the Israeli right-wing position, as these things happen and things continue to be entrenched, the way to get back to the two-state solution is more and more difficult. You have to wade through a whole series of bureaucratic and discursive and physical factors that just make it that much harder. And this is why we see not just more ideas floating around out there, but more emphasis and more support for alternate ideas. Mm-hmm. And those alternate ideas include a one-state solution. And a one-state solution could look like many different things. It could look like Israeli Jewish supremacy. It could look like a majority Palestinian state. I've seen a lot more emphasis on confederation. And confederation can mean, you know, it can look in practice like many different things. But the idea that you can have two entities and they share some elements of sovereignty while they also are autonomous in certain areas, you know, again, how you get to any of those is just extremely difficult. You have a very asymmetrical conflict. Palestinians are extremely weak vis-a-vis Israel because they're divided. They are, by any material measurement, they're much weaker. They simply don't have enough support in the international community to promote their own priorities and demands and preferences over Israel. They've made progress. More countries will recognize now Palestine as an independent state, but there are limits to that. And so for those who support a two-state solution or who want a peaceful end to this conflict, whether it's rights-based or whether it's sovereignty-based, I'm pessimistic, and I don't think that there's a whole lot to be kind of, you know, there's not a whole lot of things going on that really give you hope.
Mm. Fayez Ahmad, how much is this, you know, this pessimism and this sort of the distance now we have from what looks like a feasible peace proposal from the two sides, how much of that is laid at the feet of the United States, you know, perhaps of the current administration or just of administrations that have drifted away from a peace proposal that would be accepted by both sides as the goal versus just the political expediency of a support for the state of Israel? Would a different administration change the calculation terribly much?
Well, perhaps only at the margins, because the Trump's position has not just landed on us from nowhere. The U.S. used to pride itself as being the honest broker in the conflict between the Arabs and the Israelis. That position, nobody believes that, and not even the U.S. administrations, forget this one, kind of promoted or claimed to be that. And it's becoming a dirty word in the U.S. Polity to claim that the U.S. is being neutral or honest broker. That's becoming utterly unacceptable position in the American political system. So the United States involvement underscores the importance, the supreme importance of a great power sponsorship to the state of Israel's security. Hence, conceived as such, the U.S. has never been the honest broker that it initially claimed, and it has been to the detriment mostly of Palestinians to have kept hope alive, so to speak, over the years that the U.S. could produce, kind of lean on Israel. We see the reality on the ground shifting or moving in the opposite, squarely in the opposite direction, and therefore the U.S., it seems, has managed over the years to balance its commitment to the state of Israel, which, you know, it's kind of, you know, a given reality in the Arab world, but the once that commitment exceeds to the occupied territories in violation of international law, it becomes an untenable position. But the U.S. has basically managed to reconcile that commitment with the maintaining friendly relations with the Arab states. Hence, it could claim, said, you know what, despite the contradiction stuff, the U.S. has managed to file and stuff, you know, portfolios peacefully, relatively speaking, in the region. But, of course, what's missing from this perspective is the undercurrents and the pressures being built or accumulated underneath the surface that could complicate, if not worse, the United States position and all players, including that of Israel. And therefore, you have now a kind of impasse where, you know, the parties, the powerful parties, the Israel and the United States, are not able to clinch, so to speak, the end of conflict by passing this proposal or others similar to it. And as such, that would leave all other options open. As Brent had said, well, for example, the two-state solution is not dead until it's actually dead, but it has been pronounced it so many times, so we don't know actually what the exact time of it. But ultimately, things will continue the way they are, and the reality is on the ground, you have a continued, well, the de facto situation is that Israel is the sovereign power between the river and the Mediterranean Sea, and this plan attempts to codify that, to provide it at least the U.S. stamp to become a de jure sort of position. So the reality is that you have Arabs, Palestinians, and Israelis all under the Israeli control, irrespective of this is called. In fact, the negotiations between Netanyahu himself and the Palestinians in the 2012, particularly with Iraq, with Saeb Erekat, Netanyahu proposed the same exact ideas, and he told him, you could call it anything you want. You want to call it Israel, a state, you could do that, or sultanate, or an empire, for all I want, for all I care. So at the end of the day, the realities on the ground will continue until such a time comes where there's enough people in both sides and up their allies abroad where they will say this is unacceptable. This is kind of an apartheid-like situation, and you have a need, either as a result of an external jolt to the system in the territories and in Israel, or as a recognition from the bottom up to bring about a change. And we've seen that happening in other instances, whether in South Africa or other places, where when the historical circumstances assembled in a particular fashion, the unthinkable could become thinkable and the other way around. So one definitely, while there is no sufficient ground for any hope at this time, the continuation of the current patterns, they more certainly will worsen, but to a point, one hope at least, will bring about a radical change on the ground. Mm.
And so with that consideration then, some sort of radical change on the ground, I guess, you know, some of the dates for those of us who are watching this issue are, that are particularly important, the Israeli elections are what, the first week in March? Is that correct, Brent?
I believe they are coming up soon. I forget the exact date.
Yeah.
March the 2nd, I believe.
March 2nd, okay.
March the 2nd. So that certainly can play a substantial role, whether within U.S. elections and, of course, you know, issues about states and their relationship with Israel, and in particular, you know, some of the debates in the U.S. about whether or not withdrawing U.S. support through things like the so-called BDS movement, this boycott movement, is a way to kind of try to radically alter some of the power calculations. But of course, electorally, the power calculations are, you know, seem to be fairly static. So with that in mind, I suppose all three of us are a bit pessimistic about the possibility of peace, the possibility that this proposal is the pathway to peace, and that ultimately we will probably end up continuing this conversation months or sadly probably years from now. So with that in mind, thank you very much, Brent Sasley and Fayez Ahmad, for your contributions, and we will certainly continue to follow the story.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you very much. Brent Sasley is Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Texas, Arlington. He's the author of Politics of Israel, Governing a Complex Society, and a recent article for the Washington Post on the peace process. Fayez Ahmad is Lecturer of International Relations and Middle East Studies at the University of Southern California. He is a frequent commentator on Middle East politics.
When we come back, we may have gone overboard in killing our microbes, and that may be causing some of today's epidemics. Stay tuned. You are listening to The Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. Sanitation and antibiotics have saved the lives of many, but are they also culprits behind some of our modern diseases? Our next guest argues that we may have gone overboard in killing our microbes, and that may be causing some of today's epidemics. Martin Blaser is a professor of translational medicine and director of the Human Microbiome Program at New York University. His book is called Missing Microbes: How the Overuse of Antibiotics is Fueling Our Modern Plagues. Welcome, Martin Blaser. It's great to have you here on the Scholar Circle.
I'm really happy to be here.
Your primary argument in Missing Microbes: How the Overuse of Antibiotics is Fueling Our Modern Plagues is really that a lot of our illnesses today are really resulting from killing off a lot of these microbes that help our health in many ways. I thought where we should start is what these microorganisms are themselves. You describe them almost like ecosystems.
Most of the cells in the human body are, in fact, microbial cells. That is bacteria and, to a lesser extent, fungi and protozoa. Where the bacterial cells outnumber our human cells at least 3-1 and maybe 10-1. So we're mostly bacteria. If you took all the bacteria together and put them on a scale, they'd weigh about 3 or 4 pounds, about the same weight as our brain. And what we know is that these bacteria essentially are ancient, that we got them from our mom, and she got them from her mom, and so on and so forth, all the way back in time. Not only from our mom, but that's a very important source. These bacteria do many good things for us. They help train our immune system. They help us digest food. They make vitamins for us. They help keep out invaders. So these are very useful. We could call them the good guys.
You've said in the book that really this ecology of microbes, you call it the microbiome, are really key to our immune system. What examples can you give us?
We've been doing a lot of studies in mice, and others have done studies in mice, and it's clear that the distribution of these microbes, let's say we and others in the field are doing a lot of work, we're taking a census. We're saying, okay, which microbes are present in my body and in your body, and what about my intestine versus my skin? How are they similar? How are they different? And I can tell you that if we compared my skin and your skin, our skin is closer to each other than my skin is to my mouth, for example, because each niche has its own population, as you said, its own ecosystem.
Is there some comparison we can make to the non-microbe world that can help us to understand these unique ecosystems that each of us has?
Maybe we should start by saying, what is an ecosystem? And that's a collection of species, more or less all living together. We see that in ponds and lakes, in forests, on prairies. We see all different kinds of species. On the prairies, we see different kinds of grasses and different animals and worms and fungi. They're all living together. They've been living together in general for stable ecosystems for a very long period of time. And they really pretty much define the life that is present. And they're kind of hard to budge. so that when an invader comes in, they have a hard time getting a foothold because the local species keep them out. And, of course, we think that's true within the human body as well, that the populations of different kinds of species in our skin, on our gut, in our mouth, very complex groups of organisms, they're functioning to do their work. They're all trying to eat and have babies and baby microbes. In doing this, they have functions that are beneficial to us, and that's why we're so interested in them.
Let's talk about what is happening, the antibiotic use, because this is really the thrust of your book. You're essentially saying that most of these modern plagues, especially things like obesity, are connected directly to the abundance of antibiotics and also when they're introduced to people.
First, let's start with some facts, and that is that since World War II, a number of diseases have become much more common than they were before. That's what we could call our modern epidemics or our modern plagues. And these include such things as asthma and skin allergies, eczema, food allergies, wheat allergy, includes obesity and diabetes, even autism, inflammatory bowel disease. So imagine that you had 10 diseases that are all arising more or less in parallel. Either they have 10 different causes that all happened at the same time, or there's one thing that is underlying everything. And that's my theory, which I discuss in Missing Microbes, is that there is one thing underlying it, and that is a change in our ancient microbiome, our ancient ecosystem that we've had since time immemorial, as an unintended consequence of all the medical advances that we have, including especially antibiotics.
And let's break down some of the numbers. You talked about how much more obesity there is just in the past decade, not only in the U.S., but you noticed it in places like Chichen Itza.
Obesity is rising all over the world, especially in developed countries like the United States and Europe. But it's beginning to be present in China. It's beginning to be present in India. Even in Africa, obesity may be a bigger problem than malnutrition is. In the last decades, this has just come up worldwide. So something very important must be going on that is shared. Now, there's a lot of interest, of course, in food and calories and taking in too many calories. But diet alone hasn't been sufficient for us to understand what's going on in obesity. Diet is important, but it's not enough. And again, my hypothesis is that changes in our microbiome, these cells that are doing work for us, are important. And I want to introduce another concept, and that is we can think about the organisms in us at different stages of life. And to me, the most important organisms are the ones that are present early in life when we're really young kids, or our kids are really young, or our grandkids. We know now that these organisms are part of the development of our systems, of our processes in the body, metabolism, immunity, maybe even cognition. So if you perturb them early in life, you may change the course of development toward an individual who is pretty much destined to gain a lot of weight, for example.
How is this happening? One, you mentioned, is the antibiotics introduced at a very young age because it kills a lot of these microbes or it disturbs the balance. But the other you talk about is this increasing use of cesareans. How can that be related?
So we humans are mammals, and one of the characteristics of mammals is that they produce live birth, and the baby goes through a birth canal. So we don't lay eggs like birds do. And in the course of passing from the womb through the birth canal, a baby is picking up all these microbes from their mom. Part of the heredity of being a mammal is that you pick up your mom's microbes on your way out. And then you continue to pick up mom's microbes through contact with skin and mouth. But when a baby is born by cesarean section, they're missing this early contact. They're missing their introduction with the organisms that in other kids become the foundation for all the microbes in their body.
The connection with things like diabetes, celiac disease, how are these all related?
Well, there have been epidemiologic studies in which groups of moms and babies have been studied, large groups of hundreds or thousands of people, showing that babies born by C-section were more likely to have some of the markers of obesity, or celiac disease or juvenile diabetes. So it's not that this is a theoretical risk. There's already evidence suggesting that there may be a cost to C-section that nobody was appreciating. Not a cost a day after birth or a week after birth, but a cost that's manifesting 10 years after birth, 20 years after birth. And there are precedents for this. And I want to come back to one of the earlier points, because for me, one day a light bulb went off. And that was, I knew for a long time that farmers feed antibiotics to their farm animals so that they'll gain weight. This is very widely done. It's where most of the antibiotics in the United States are going, on the farm, not to people. They're going to farm animals for the express purpose of promoting growth. And the reason they do this and they use so much antibiotics is because it works. They found that if they give antibiotics to young animals, they'll gain weight faster. Their feed efficiency improves. That's the ability to change food calories into body mass. And one day for me, about 10 years ago, a light bulb went off, and I thought, well, farmers are doing that, feeding antibiotics to increase the growth of their livestock. What are we doing to our children? Is it possible that the antibiotics we're giving our young kids for their throat infections, their ear infections, is having an unintended consequence, and that is that it's fattening them up? And that's what we've been working on for the last 10 years, and I talk about some of this work in Missing Microbes.
In terms of the unintended consequences, there are also others. We've got antibiotics in our water, in our soil, in our food. We're also seeing resistant bacteria.
Anytime antibiotics are used, it selects for resistance. Antibiotics will kill the susceptible bacteria, and the ones that are resistant will remain, and they'll take over the spot where the susceptible ones were. This is what Charles Darwin called natural selection. He didn't even recognize this with microbes, but ultimately Darwin was right. If you don't believe in Darwin's concepts of evolution, all you have to do is study bacteria and the development of antibiotic resistance, and you see it very clearly.
What's the consequence of some of these resistant bacteria?
Consequences, unfortunately, are very serious. Before we had antibiotics, people would die from pneumonia. They would die from meningitis. They might die of blood poisoning from a splinter or something like that. There were many fatal infections. Now, with antibiotics, most of those infections are treatable. Most of them are curable. Also, in order to do cancer chemotherapy, to do transplantation, to do major surgery, we needed an umbrella of antibiotics around so that if somebody gets sick, we can treat them. I'm a doctor. If we have somebody who's getting chemotherapy, infection is a very major problem. So we can treat them with antibiotics. It would be a shame to suppress somebody's tumor, but then they die of an infection. So in order to have modern medicine, we need antibiotics. And if the antibiotics stop working because our bacteria have become resistant to them, then we could move back to an era when we can't do these surgeries. It's not just the cases of pneumonia, but it's the very ability to do things that we now take for granted, surgery, hip replacements. You know, if you didn't have antibiotics, you couldn't really do hip replacements because infections occur and they could be lethal.
And given that the antibiotics are so prevalent now in food, in water, in the soil, and is there any avoiding it?
Well, that's a very good question. There have been surveys that showed that because of the tremendous use of antibiotics on the farm, when you go to the supermarket, your meat may be contaminated by antibiotics. According to the regulations, it's not supposed to happen. But surveys have shown that it does happen. Not in every case, but in some cases. And we haven't surveyed this enough, but we know it can be present in meat. We know it can be present in milk. And some cities, their drinking water intake is just downstream of the effluent from one of these large industrial farms, so they're getting antibiotics in their water. What we can say is that there are probably millions of exposures every day in the United States of people to low levels of antibiotics, trace levels of antibiotics. What's the consequence? We don't know. Maybe there is no consequence. Maybe it's completely safe. Or maybe when you talk about it millions of times, that's what's contributing to so many of these rising diseases.
I think I saw in your book, Missing Microbes, that they had found resistant bacteria in about half the samples of meat that they tested.
It depends on the survey, but whether it's 20% or 80%, when you eat meat that you get at the supermarket, there's a reasonable chance that there is some trace level of antibiotic. And also the milk that our children drink. Kids who are drinking milk every day, there's a risk that they're getting antibiotics. Some parents say, my child has never had an antibiotic, but probably that's not true.
I noticed you were writing about neurons in our guts, and you said there's something like 100 million neurons. And these neurons signal to the brain all kinds of things related to hunger, mood, cognitive development. But they're signaling based on interaction with microbes. How is this affected by the antibiotic use?
I'll give you the bottom line first. We don't know. It's a wide open question. But as you say, there's an increasing body of evidence that the nature of the microbes in our gut, the composition of them, the genes that they carry, affect the signals, the neural signals going from our gut via a number of nerves right up to the brain. I mean, sometimes people say, I feel hungry in my gut. Somehow your brain has learned that. That's a very simple example. But there are increasing connections between the gut and the development of the brain in terms of thinking, of cognition. There's some work suggesting there's a relationship with mood. You know, the nervous system is a big chemical factory, and some of the chemicals that are coming in from below could definitely influence what's going on.
Well, let me just remind listeners that we're speaking with Martin Blaser, and he is the author of Missing Microbes, How the Overuse of Antibiotics is Fueling Our Modern Plagues. Now, let's go back to the plagues. We've talked a lot about obesity. We talked a little bit about diabetes. We mentioned celiac disease. But there were several others that you had talked about in the book. One is the esophageal reflux, which causes heartburn. One is asthma. One is eczema. How many of these so-called modern plagues do you think are related to the overuse of antibiotics?
You mentioned esophageal reflux, asthma, and eczema. And these have been related to an organism that lives in the stomach called Helicobacter pylori. It's an organism I've been studying for about 30 years. And Helicobacter was discovered in the 1980s to be a major cause of stomach ulcers. In fact, the people who discovered it won the Nobel Prize. And later, we and others discovered that this bacteria had a major role in stomach cancer. So everything was indicating that this was a very bad organism. But the more we studied it, the more we realized that this organism is quite ancient, that people have had it in their stomach since time immemorial. But as a result of modern life, this bacterium is disappearing. And this is one of the places that I got the idea about four missing microbes, that some of our ancient organisms that are longtime residents, our friends, are disappearing. Well, Helicobacter is not just a friend because it can cause ulcers and it can cause cancer. But there now is a wide body of research suggesting that Helicobacter also protects the esophagus, protecting against high acid and reflux, and that people who don't have Helicobacter are at much higher risk for getting reflux esophagitis, and occasionally they can get a condition called Barrett's esophagus, and occasionally they can get esophageal cancer as well. So as Helicobacter is disappearing, gastric cancer is disappearing, but esophageal cancer is rising, and asthma is rising, and eczema is rising, and we have found evidence linking the lack of Helicobacter to these diseases, as if Helicobacter pylori was protective against getting these diseases, and now we've lost it.
In essence, if we were going to then turn to solutions, would you say that besides the reduction in use of the antibiotics, do you think that the germophobia is a little bit too extreme? We thought that we had to be more sanitary in order to protect life. Now, are we too sanitary?
I think you hit the nail on the head with the term you use, germophobia. Because there are some very bad germs, like the germ that causes tuberculosis or the virus that causes HIV, etc., because there are very bad germs, we have focused on those, forgetting for the moment that the world is full of germs. We live in a world of bacteria. Most of them are neutral to us, and many of them are good for us. They're beneficial to us, like many of the organisms in our own body. And so, to me, the fear is that by using these antibacterial substances, we use these soaps, they're in certain foods, etc., that we're causing collateral damage to our good guys, the good bacteria. And ultimately, when we have people washing their hands tens of millions of times a day across the United States with these antibacterial soaps, I don't know whether we're doing more good or more harm. It just hasn't been determined. But on a positive note, I think positive, the state of Minnesota banned the use of antibacterial soaps. They said there's no reason to use it. It's no better than soap and water. And I applaud that because I'm concerned that those antibiotic soaps are wounding our microbiome, our ancient composition. It's not like it's wounding us, but we're getting a lot of benefit from it. It's not clear that we're getting any benefit from it. And so there's only a biological cost.
In terms of other potential policies, solutions, it sounds like you also think this overuse of antibiotic on the farms is a big problem.
Yes, it is a big problem because it's spilling over into humans, the antibiotic residues in food. And also it's a problem because of resistant organisms. When antibiotics are used on the farm, it selects for bacteria that are resistant to their action, and sometimes these bacteria come over to humans. There have been many examples with Salmonella and Campylobacter, two important disease-causing organisms. The use on the farm has made some of these strains antibiotic resistant, and now when people are getting the infections from eating the foods of animal origin, they're getting infected with antibiotic-resistant organisms. So this actually has been well known for a number of years, and the Food and Drug Administration is taking some early steps to ban the use of antibiotics on the farm. I would call it baby steps. And our free and aroused citizenry has to push the policymakers to actually do the right thing, to get these antibiotics out of the farm. In Europe, they banned it about 10 years ago.
Martin Blaser, thank you so much for being with us here on the Scholar Circle.
It's really my pleasure to talk to you.
The book, again, is called Missing Microbes, How the Overuse of Antibiotics is Fueling Our Modern Plagues. And that's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to those who make this program possible. To Sud Dongre, our webmaster, contributing host Doug Becker, Ankine Arasyan, Melissa Chiprin, Mike Hurst, and Tim Page. Most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can check out our archives at scholarcircle.org, kpfk.org, and please like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at Armudian, and we'll see you next week.